Suddenly it tapped my brother on the right knee, and a voice directly in front of him said, "Eric Saunders." My brother asked if the voice were addressing him, and it replied yes, whereupon he said that there must be some mistake, as he had never known anybody of that name. The voice was not very strong, so some person suggested that the company should continue singing, and, while this was going on, the trumpet kept tapping my brother on his knee, arm and shoulder. It was so insistent that he said, "I think we had better stop singing, as some person evidently is most anxious to speak to me." Again he asked who it was, and the voice, much stronger this time, repeated, "Eric Saunders." Again my brother said that he had never known any person of that name, and asked where he had met him. The reply was, "In the army." My brother mentioned a number of places, such as Aldershot, Bagley, France, Palestine, etc., but carefully omitted Lowestoft, where he had been stationed for the greater part of his army life. The voice replied, "No, none of these places. I knew you when you were near Lowestoft." My brother asked why he said near Lowestoft, and he replied, "You were not in Lowestoft then, but at Gessingland. This is a small fishing hamlet about 5 miles south of Lowestoft, where my brother spent part of 1917. My brother then asked what company he had been attached to, and, as he could not make out whether B said B or C, my brother asked if he could remember the name of the company commander. The reply was McNamara. 89. This was the name of the officer commanding B Company at that time. By way of a test, my brother pretended that he remembered the man, and said, "Oh yes, you were one of my Lewis gunners, were you not?" The reply was, "No, you had not the Lewis guns then, it was the Hotchkiss." This was quite correct, as the Lewis guns were taken from them in April 1917, and were replaced by Hotchkiss. My brother asked him two or three leading questions, such as the name of his, my brother's billet, which he answered correctly, and then Saunders said, "We had great times there, sir. Do you remember the general's inspection?" My brother laughed, and said that they were continually being inspected by generals. To which one did he refer? And he replied, "The day the general made us all race about with the guns." This was an incident my brother remembered perfectly well, and one which caused a good deal of amusement to the men at the time. He told my brother he had been killed in France, and my brother asked him when he had gone out. He replied that he had gone with the big draft in August 1917. My brother asked him why he called it the big draft, and he said, "Don't you remember the big draft, when the colonel came on the parade ground and made a speech?" This reference was to a particularly large draft sent out to France that month, and was the only occasion on which my brother remembered the colonel ever personally saying goodbye to the men. He then thanked my brother for the gunnery training he had given him, and said it had been most useful to him in France. My brother asked him why he had come through to speak to him, and he said, "Because I have never forgotten that you once did me a good turn." My brother has a hazy recollection of obtaining leave for one of the gunners, owing to some special circumstances, but whether or not his name was Saunders, he could not remember. About 6 months after the above incident, my brother was in London, and met, by appointment, the corporal who had been his assistant with the light guns in his battalion at that time. My brother told him the above story, and asked if he remembered any man named Eric Saunders. My brother had been training gunners for nearly 2 years at the rate of about a dozen a fortnight, and 90. Beyond putting them through their examinations, and taking a general oversight of them, he never came into sufficiently close personal contact with them to get to know many of their names. The corporal, however, whom my brother met, was more with the gunners, but he did not remember any person of this name. Fortunately, however, the corporal had brought with him an old pocket diary, in which he had been in the habit of keeping a full list of men under training, and other information. He pulled it out of his pocket, and together they looked back until they came to records of B Company during 1917. Sure enough, the name appeared there. Eric Saunders, FQ. August 17th, with a red ink line drawn through it, FQ stood for fully qualified, and, though my brother knew the meaning of the red ink line, He asked the corporal what it meant. He replied, "Don't you remember, Mr. Findlay, I always drew a line through the men's names when they went away." This shows that Saunders went out in August 1917. Unfortunately, my brother did not ask Saunders the name of his regiment, and consequently I could not trace his death. The War Office, without this information, being unable to supply me with any details beyond the fact that over 4,000 men of the name of Saunders fell in the war. Men came to Lowestoft from all over the country for training, so my brother had no record of Saunders' regiment. Even allowing for this, it is a remarkable case, as it is fraud proof, telepathy proof, and cryptaesthesia proof. Not only did no one present know my brother, but my brother did not know the speaker, and cannot even today recollect him, as he was passing hundreds of men through their training, all of whom would know him, but he never had an opportunity to know them individually. This case contains 14 separate facts, each one was correct, and each one comes up to my A1 standard. Clairvoyance present described Saunders standing in front of us speaking, and, with a smile, saluting my brother before he left us. I shall now give another A1 case. Case 2A1. One day when in Edinburgh I visited the Reverend John Lomond, D.D., a friend of mine, and noticed an oil painting on his study mantelpiece. Remarking on it, I was told that it was a painting by the trance painter. 91. David Dugard, who died in the early part of this century. It has a history, my friend told me, and then went on to say, I had that painted once, many years ago when I visited David Dugard in Glasgow, and, as my family did not believe in this method of painting, I promptly put it in a tin box. Some years later, after the death of Dugard, my friend was at a direct voice seance in London, and a voice spoke to him giving the name David Dugard. You surely do not value my painting, Dr. Lomond, said David. Why? Said my friend. If you did, you would not keep it in a box in your room. My friend had forgotten where he had put it, but told Dugard that he would search for it and put it on his mantelpiece. Just as Dugard had said, it was in the box referred to, and my friend kept his promise and placed it on his mantelpiece. This was the story I was told the day I visited Dr. Lomond in Edinburgh. I never mentioned it to anyone, and he did not know Sloane. Now for the sequel. Sometime after the story of the picture was told to me, I took to one of Sloane's seances Dr. W. P. Patterson, Professor of Divinity at Edinburgh University and former moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. He had never heard the story from his friend Dr. Lomond, who is rather sensitive about touching on a subject in which his friends disbelieve. However, Drive Patterson came with me to Sloane's house one night. He sat beside me, and was not introduced to anyone present. He had never seen Sloane before, and Sloane certainly did not know him. First of all, he received some remarkable evidence, and then a strong voice boomed out and addressed him by name. Dr. Patterson, it said, I am David Dugard, tell your friend Dr. Lomond, 18 Regent Terrace, Edinburgh, correct, that I am much obliged to him for keeping his promise and placing my picture on his mantelpiece. Dr. Patterson was quite bewildered, and, addressing me, said, I don't know what he is talking about. I, however, knowing the story, promised Dugard to deliver the message, for which I received his thanks. This is another foolproof case and can be rightly classed A1, it being free from any other explanation than that the personality of Dugard was present and spoke. Otherwise, how could such a message have come? Case 3A1. The last A1 case I shall give relates to a lady, Mrs. Woodsims, whom I took with me one evening. Sloane's seance was timed to begin at 7:15. And on my way to it I called on the lady and asked her if she would care to come with me. As it was then past 7, she hurriedly got ready and came with me. She mentioned casually to me that she had just returned from a visit to friends in England, and I heard her make the same remark to someone just before the séance began, but no details were given, just the casual remark. During the séance a voice spoke to her, giving the name of her host's deceased son, saying, I saw you when you were staying with father at Leeds. Several other voices spoke to her, giving their names, and send messages to her host at Leeds. Two of these she did not know, but she said she would tell her host they had spoken, and pass on their messages. Mrs. Woodsims afterwards told me that her host had replied that he had known all these people on earth, and their messages were quite intelligible to him. At a later date I met this gentleman, and be confirmed what Mrs. Woodsims told me, this lady's brother, also on this occasion, spoke to her, calling her Anna. A name only he used, as she is never called by that name. He said his name was Will, but Bill to her, which was correct, and then correctly referred in detail to some advice he gave her before his death. If you had only taken it, how different your life would have been. He said. It is only too true, said my friend to me afterwards. Finally, his face materialized before her, and she assures me that it was his face in every detail. Here we have 14A1 facts recorded, and these three cases I have mentioned, containing 34A1 facts, are only three of many. Remember, in my notes, I have on record 180 facts, every one as good as those to which I have referred. Taking, however, these three cases, fraud is excluded, owing to the precautions taken. What of chance? In other words, guessing on the part of the medium. An eminent mathematician, on calculating the chances of correctly guessing all the facts recorded, considers that to have reached such accuracy represented the equivalent of 1 to 5,000 billion, in other words, the odds were 5,000 billion to 1 against chance being the explanation. That being so, we need scarcely consider it. 93. Chapter 9. More Evidence, 3A2 Cases. Truth comes to us with a slow and doubtful step, measuring the ground she treads on, and forever turning her curious eye to see that all is right behind, and with a keen survey choosing her onward path. Percival. I shall now summarize three cases which are class A2, as they do not come under quite the same category as my A1 cases, though it by no means follows that the information was normally obtained. All I mean is that some of the information was available normally, and, this being so, critics are open to give this as an explanation. Case 1A to I arranged a sitting with Sloane one evening in our society's rooms in Glasgow, and mentioned to him the name of a friend of mine who was coming. As things turned out, I was sorry I did so, as, if I had not, it would have been a wonderful A1 sitting. He was a London man, and his wife came with him. He was well known as a spiritualist and a leader in finance. His name, career and certain family matters were mentioned in WHO's WHO. This cannot explain all that took place, but just because his name was known I cannot class the case as A1. However, at least seven different voices spoke to him and his wife. They referred to family matters, gave family names and showed an intimate knowledge of his public and home life. He told me afterwards that, though he had studied the phenomena for 20 years, it was one of the most evidential and interesting sittings in which he had ever taken part. Case 28. A lady, a friend of mine, died. She belonged to a well-known family. Consequently, an obituary notice of about a quarter of a column appeared in the Glasgow Herald, giving particulars of her family and immediate ancestors. This, consequently, brings this case under the A2 category, though I know of nothing to associate her with me or my family in the mind of the medium. Sloane, I am sure, was not aware that I knew her. I am sure Sloane had never heard her name and knew nothing about her or her family, but, as some critics make out that a case loses its evidentiality if the information given can be traced to print, I place this one accordingly in the A2 category. A week after her funeral, at a sitting I and a few personal friends had with Sloane in the séance room of our society, her son, Cecil, who was killed in the war, spoke to my brother saying that he was so happy now, as he had his mother with him. I asked if she were present, and he replied she was, but not yet fully conscious that she had passed over. I asked if she could speak to me, which she did. Her conversation showed that she was not quite conscious of the change. She said she wanted her husband, naming him correctly, referred to the nature of her illness correctly, and wanted to know what had happened. I might add that the nature of her illness had not been published, and was only known to a few of her intimate friends. I explained to her the change which had taken place, that she was now an inhabitant of the etheric world, that she had left forever this world of physical matter, that she had gone through the change called death, and then I said, "Do you not recognize who is standing beside you?" referring to her son who had just spoken to me. "No," she said, "I can see no one." Here her son interposed with the remark, "Mother cannot recognize me yet." Her father then spoke to me, telling me things I afterwards found in reference books to be correct. Then her brother spoke, giving his correct name and where he lived on earth. Towards the end of the séance, after other voices had spoken, the lady returned and again spoke to me. "Have you not seen Cecil?" I said. "No, where is he?" she replied. Then her voice suddenly changed from one of sadness to joy, and we heard her exclaim, "Oh, Cecil, my darling, my own darling boy." Then there was silence. In a few minutes another voice spoke, "He is taking her away with him, she will soon be all right." I had been a participant in a great drama. I had been privileged to have had the unique experience of witnessing the return to consciousness of one the world called dead, and her meeting with her son, who had given, so the world thought, his life for his country. I had witnessed, when she was with us on earth, her terrible grief when she had heard of his death, her wonderful courage, and I was present at the final act when she and her only son became reunited. How I should have liked to tell her sorrowing husband of my 95 experience, but I knew how useless it was, so I refrained from doing so. To describe, in a few words, what took nearly 2 hours to unfold, to make one conscious of the rare personal touches which accomplished it all, is, of course, impossible. The circle consisted entirely of my own personal friends, in the séance room of our own society, and they were all deeply affected, especially my wife, who knew the lady well. Had Sloane been a great actor, knowing intimately the personalities concerned, and their family history, he could not have carried through, with such success, the various impersonations, whereas he knew nothing about her family, or my friendship with her and her son. Case 3A2. This is a peculiar case. I class it A2 as it is unevidential, but I mention it because I cannot believe its source was other than supernormal. I may say, by way of explanation, that a scientific group, on the other side, has taken a great interest in my investigations, and given me all the help they could. Later I shall have something of interest to say with regard to the scientific views they expressed from time to time. Huxley, Faraday, Alfred Russel Wallace and other scientists, first of all, started to come through to me after I took Sloane to London to see Sir William and Lady Barrett, who had known some of them personally. Immediately after that, Lady Barrett was present at 2 sittings with Sloane in London, one following the other, when Huxley and other scientists first began to manifest, sending their best wishes and congratulations to their old friend, her husband, for his persistency in keeping the fact of survival before the public. Huxley and others evidently kept in touch with me, as from that time onwards they repeatedly spoke to me. Huxley especially has given me good proof of his identity in a most evidential manner. His personal appearance has also been accurately described. I mention these facts by way of explaining why I have had so much attention from this group, but one will realize that I must qualify my statement by saying that I have only their word for it that they are the men who bore these great names on earth. With those who speak, whom you never knew, you lose the personal touches which are so convincing when they come from friends. Now I shall tell my story. On 10th of December 1923, I received a note from Sloane saying, "Before penning these lines I have the influence of a quiet man beside me who says, write to Mr. Findlay to have no fear, we shall see that he acquits himself well at the forthcoming meeting, and we will have him well informed in all matters before the meeting." I get something like Rawley as his name. This was Sloane's letter to me. The meeting referred to was one I was addressing in the lecture hall of the Glasgow Philosophical Society, and it should be noted how he spells the name. I sat with Sloane the following evening, and, In the dark, before he went into trance, he described a man standing beside me. Then he said he saw letters flashed above my head which he could make nothing of. I asked him to react them out one by one, while I noted them down. This he did very quickly, spelling them out as follows: Jili Armai. I said I could make nothing of it, and was about to lay down my pencil when he said, "There is something more." Strok Kabda he spelled out rapidly, and I took it down. It was quite unintelligible to me, so I thought no more about it, as shortly afterwards Sloane went into trance, and, besides others who spoke, was one claiming to be Huxley, who informed me, among other things, that the scientific group was present. After the sitting I referred to the jumble of letters I had taken down, and found that by reading backwards it was quite sensible. I am Rayleigh read backwards. There is nothing evidential in all this, but Lord Rayleigh was a well-known scientist, a former president of the Royal Society and of the Society for Psychical Research, and might be one of the group of scientists Huxley said was present. Now Sloane spelled Rayleigh to me in his letter as Rawley, and, after the sitting, on asking him how he spelled Rayleigh, he did so the same way. He said he had never heard of Lord Rayleigh, and never knew a name was spelled Rayleigh. The rapid way he spelled out the message backwards was remarkable. On inquiring afterwards, I found that Sloane's description of the quiet man beside me tallied with that of the late Lord Rayleigh. This is an interesting though not an evidential case, and I only mention it as such. All that happened could quite easily be explained normally. By inquiry, Rayleigh's appearance and manner could have been found out. In fact, I remember reading in the Daily Telegraph, about a month. 97. Prior to this incident, some remarks by Sir William Barrett on Lord Rayleigh in which the reporter described him as a quiet man. Believing as I do that Sloane is honest, I personally do not give this as the explanation, and further, it would require a very retentive memory to remember a string of unconnected letters, and this Sloane has not, his memory being particularly bad. I think I have now given sufficient to let one see how it is I have separated, or analyzed, the information I have received. As I have said, 83 separate voices have spoken to me or to my friends. I have obtained 181 separate items of information, and 182 separate items of information, much of which was not known to me at the time, but which I verified afterwards as correct. Only one item I have not verified, because I have not been able to, and only one has not been substantially correct. These evidential items of information are quite apart from the communications given in chapters 11, 12 and 13, entitled Night of Instruction, which, though both instructive and interesting, cannot be considered as evidence. Evidence in psychical research, to be of value, must contain information which it is impossible for the medium to have known, and the best of all evidence is information unknown to the medium and the recipient which is afterwards found to be correct. Much of what is recorded in this and the previous two chapters, and also in the chapter which follows, can legitimately be claimed as coming under this category. Chapter 10 Still More Evidence. Is anything of God's contriving endangered by inquiry? Was it the system of the universe or the monks that trembled at the telescope of Galileo? Did the circulation of the firmament stop in terror because Newton laid his daring finger on its pulse? Lowell. In the foregoing pages I have given a record of evidence I myself have experienced, but what was just as convincing was the evidence obtained by others who went with me, at times anonymously. 98. Mr. McCully, one of Glasgow, has kindly given me permission to mention his name and record a few of his experiences. Mr. McCully is a shrewd, level-headed businessman, and has only come by degrees to believe in the reality of the phenomena, through having obtained evidence, which he cannot explain otherwise than by the fact that the information he received came from his friends who had died but still lived, and remembered their time on earth. I could give numerous experiences which other friends of mine have had, but to do so would run my record into several volumes. I shall therefore conclude these chapters of evidence by giving some cases which Mr. McCully has written out himself in his own handwriting, and vouched for by his own signature. Mr. McCulley has had 18 years close association with Sloane, and his experiences have been many and varied. When I asked him to give me some of these, he replied that his difficulty was to select those cases which could be considered most evidential, as he has received so much evidence throughout all these years. However, he selected four experiences, and what follows on this and the next two pages was written by him and not by me. One of the most vivid and impressive messages I have ever received was from a young brother, Johnny by name. He had passed over suddenly at the age of 12 years. He was the youngest of the family, and of course the apple of his mother's eye. Shortly after his death she went to Australia. Every letter from my other brothers in Australia told me of her grief and despondency. Well, Johnny came through to me at one of Sloane's seances. After establishing his identity, I asked him if he knew where his mother was. "Yes," he replied, "I have just left her. She is in a big ship sitting on deck taking tea." Through my mind flashed the thought, "Is mother coming home?" And this mental question must have been read by him as he continued, "No, I do not think so, but write and tell her not to grieve so much. Her grief makes me unhappy, and I cannot be happy while she is so unhappy." Footnote. I gave his address in the earlier editions of this book, but, as he was troubled by callers and letters inquiring for Sloane's address, I must omit it in this and future editions at his especial request. 99. Well, to me the message was not understandable. I could not understand what my mother was doing on a big ship if she were not coming home, but at any rate I wrote out Johnny's message and sent it on to Perth, in Western Australia. A week or two later a letter came telling me that a brother had, in an attempt to lift her despondency, bought his mother a ticket for a first-class trip round Australia, and that she was then on her way to visit a daughter in Sydney. When in Sydney, the daughter took her mother to a medium, where she got the same message from Johnny in the same words, namely, not to grieve so much as it made him so unhappy. Some time afterwards, on leaving my house going to business in the morning, I met the postman. He knew I was always looking for letters from France as I had three brothers serving. He handed me an envelope, and, when I opened it, it contained a cable that mother had died. I decided to tell nobody and wait and see what would happen. I had not seen Mr. Sloane for about 3 months, but that afternoon I received word that he had a sitting that evening. I attended, and at the seance there were three or four ministers in the circle, and many voices spoke to them. One especially seemed to be holding a reception of all his passed over congregation, names and addresses being correctly given. Towards the end, I caught the medium by the hand, and, addressing the control, said, "Come Whitey, have you never a word for an old friend?" He replied, "Go away, Cully Chief, I don't want to speak to you." I said, "Oh, what have I done?" But he persisted, "I don't want to speak to you." I still held the medium's hand, and Mrs. Sloane, who was clairvoyant, said, "Don't torment him, he does not want to tell you." But I still persisted, and then she said, "There is a lady who has been standing behind your chair all night." Whitey then said, "I am sorry, Cully, but it is your mother." I said, "It's all right, Whites, I was expecting her, has she anything to say to me?" Immediately the trumpet rose and a whisper came, "Sandy, Sandy, I want to give you a message from your father. He wants you to write to his people. He is not pleased with you." This was a complete thunderbolt. I had quarreled with my father's people over money matters. It had happened years previously. I had not given it a thought for years. No one in that room, I am certain, knew my affairs. 100. And it was just such a message as he would send, no more, no less. Towards the end of the war one had a visitor, a young soldier from Perth in Australia. I took him up to Sloane's one night, and to him came a voice giving a name and regiment, but he said, "Sorry, but I do not know you." The voice replied, "You will find my name on the war memorial in Perth." "I don't know any war memorial in Perth," my friend replied, "where is it?" "It is in Avenue," the name was given but I have forgotten it. "Well," my friend said, "I know Perth pretty well, but I do not know any avenue of that name.